and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us on Alaska Public Media as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
On the show today, we'll be hearing an unfiltered look at U.S. national security from former U.S. Ambassador John Negroponte. Ambassador Negroponte also served as Deputy Secretary of State and First Director of National Intelligence under President George W. Bush. He'll be speaking with General Joseph Ralston, who served as Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. This event was sponsored by the Alaska World Affairs Council and was held at 49th State Brewing Company on October 19th. David Ramser, Chair of the Board of the Alaska World Affairs Council, provides the introduction today.
The World Affairs Council has been working to get Ambassador Negroponte here for many years, and we're pleased that he finally made it. You know, a couple nights ago, I was catching up on the Ken Burns Vietnam series and was a little surprised to see Ambassador Negroponte pop up. I think most of us know him from his recent service in Iraq and as Director of National Intelligence under President George W. Bush, but Ambassador Negroponte has had two long tours in government over nearly 40 years, starting in 1960 and again in 2001. And among his duties in those early years was as director for Vietnam in the Nixon administration and then deputy national security advisor under President Reagan. He also has served as ambassador to Honduras, Mexico, the Philippines, and the United Nations. And in 2009, Ambassador Negroponte joined the international consulting and lobbying firm McLarty Associates, founded by President Clinton's chief of staff. He has received numerous awards for his public service, including the State Department's highest honor, the Distinguished Service Medal, which he received twice. His full bio is on our website, as is General Ralston's. And General Joe Ralston is no stranger to our stage. He graciously makes himself available to the council when we need some real star power. As Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Ralston was our nation's second highest ranking military officer. He completed a distinguished 37-year Air Force career as commander of the U.S. European Command and Supreme Allied Commander at NATO. And there at NATO, he contributed to preserving the peace and security while commanding 65,000 troops from 37 NATO and other nations participating in Bosnia, Kosovo, and the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. And his bio is also on the website. So please join me in welcoming to our stage Ambassador John Negroponte and General Joe Ralston.
David, thank you very much. And let me kick off here in just a couple of other comments. I am extremely honored to be here with Ambassador Negroponte this evening. He really is one of the great public servants of our nation. And in addition to all the things that have been said there, I think this audience would also appreciate that Senator Ted Stevens used to tell me time and time again how much he respected Ambassador Negroponte and what a great friend Ambassador Negroponte was to Ted Stevens. So that's very meaningful to this particular audience, Mr. Ambassador. I'd like to go ahead and I will ask a few questions here to get things started, and then we'll turn it over to questions from the audience. First I'd like to talk about is North Korea. And to lay the groundwork for that, I have to go back to the 23rd of January, 1968. That's almost 50 years ago. I was a lieutenant flying F-105s out of Okinawa and was launched into Osan, Korea, as the North Koreans were towing the USS Pueblo into Wonsan Harbor. We stayed for a year and a half in Korea, and this was during the Johnson administration, and we didn't do anything. Next year, in 69, President Nixon was president. Kim Jong-un's grandfather, Kim Il-sung, was in power at the time. He shot down a U.S. Air Force RC-121 with 20-some people on board, killed them. We did nothing. In 1994, when I was commander here of Alaskan Command, I was directed by the Secretary of Defense to to put a squadron of F-15Es on alert, fully loaded with a bomb load, pilots in the cockpit on 15-minute alert, to go and bomb North Korea. We came as close in 1994 to going to war with North Korea, I think closer than any time in my career. That was over the fact that Kim Jong-un's father had made an agreement that he would stop enriching nuclear materials in exchange for X amount of fuel oil. We gave them the fuel oil. They cheated and kept the enrichment going. And I think when threatened with the attack, he backed down. So my question to the ambassador, where we are today with North Korea, is this just another step in the last 50 years of things that have gone on, or is this time different?
Good evening. Thank you, first of all, General, for coming here to do this interview with me, because I know you went to some lengths to accomplish that, and you have a busy schedule. And although you're a resident of Alaska, you're also away on business a lot of the time. So thank you very much for that. It's a great pleasure and an honor to be interviewed by you. And it's and also thanks to the Alaska World Affairs Council for hosting this and the event tomorrow. I don't know what you call this event tonight. What is this? The happy hour before before lunch tomorrow. Whatever. It's great to see all of you. And before getting into this very, really serious matter of North Korea, I do want to say, just give you some background as to why Ted Stevens and I were such good friends and why Alaska played such a role in my Foreign Service career. At the time of the extension to 200-mile jurisdiction over resources back in 1977, it so happened that I was appointed to be the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Oceans and Fisheries with the rank of ambassador. Had to go through the eye of the needle of Warren Magnuson to get my confirmation. And it started out, was a rocky start. He said, "What do you know about fish?" But it got better after that. Ted, I led a delegation that met numerous times with the Japanese and Canadian counterparts during that time to renegotiate the International North Pacific Fisheries Convention. And any of you who know what that treaty is about know that what we did back in 1977, 78, 79 was to move the Japanese high seas salmon fisheries fleets 10 degrees further west because they had been poaching on Bristol Bay sockeye salmon and decimating those stocks. And the effect of accomplishing that treaty was to ultimately end the Japanese high seas fishery, because 10 degrees further west, it was no longer a viable economic proposition for them. But it was a really tough negotiation. It's sort of where I learned a lot. It was a great preparation for the rest of my career, I gotta tell you. And fisheries tends to be a zero-sum game when you're negotiating about these things. And you also have this very, very interesting aspect of the fishermen actually accompany you at the talks. I mean, I had a huge delegation. I had 25 or 30 fishermen, and also some bankers, Alaskan bankers, who wanted to see how this was all going to go, like Elmer Rasmussen, who some of you no doubt knew, and Clem Tillian, who I'm sorry to hear is not going to be here, and he's away traveling somewhere. But we had Eskimos, we had everything. And I used to mooch cigarettes off the Eskimos because I told them I was trying to stop smoking. But it was hard to do during the talks. And I remember after it was all over and I walked back in, I'd gone into a secret private meeting with my Japanese counterpart, and he was hitting his head and he was going, "Ooh, too small an area." He didn't want such a confined area to fish for these sockeye salmon, but you know, he knew it was curtains. We had great leverage because we'd gone to 200 miles. Therefore, we controlled the access to these very valuable other fish, bottom fish and pollock and all of that, that they wanted access to. And we told them, you're not going to get that pollock and those access to all of that other stuff if you don't get off of our salmon. That was basically the deal. But when I finally reported back to the delegation as to, you know, what had happened, great, great. I mean, there was just great joy in the room. It was just absolutely palpable. And I got to tell you, the Alaskan fishermen, I'm sure there's some of you in this room here, are just the nicest people in the world. And they really were a delight to work with. And my reward from the Eskimos was about a month or two later, I got a whole carton of cigarettes that they they sent to my office. I'm sorry for this digression, but you got to understand, I went and defended this negotiation afterwards in front of Senator Stevens in the Senate, and so on and so forth. And one thing led to another, and we established a really great friendship over the ensuing years, and really right to the last days of his life. North Korea. Well, you know, I should ask General Ralston, why the heck didn't you just go and bomb the hell out of them back then? Because the problem just, I mean, the logic of that situation is that it just gets more and more difficult as time goes on. And if you look at it retrospectively, what we sort of had was two step forward and three step back, and we'd make some progress on some aspect of the situation. But meanwhile, their capabilities never diminished, and they kept adding to them, and to the point where now they have they've got plenty of fissionable material. There's an estimate that they've got whatever it is, enough plutonium for, I don't know, six or seven bombs. I think the estimate is that they actually have these bombs. The question is whether they've miniaturized them skillfully enough so they can put them on the tip of a missile and deliver them someplace. But I mean, they're inexorably seem to be moving towards that capability, and they've been testing the missile capability more and more as time goes by. So you ask the question, is it different this time? And I'm not entirely certain. Certainly when you listen to the president talk, both he and General Mattis too talk as if there's a military plan, that there's a military option that is viable. The conventional wisdom that I sort of became accustomed to was that a military option is terribly dangerous, because it invites the likelihood that the North Koreans would retaliate, and Seoul, Korea is only 30 or 40 miles from the demilitarized zone. And with conventional artillery and rockets, North Korea could rain havoc on the capital of South Korea, a booming metropolis of whatever it is, 20 million people, so that the retaliatory effects of this would be tremendous. But even Mr. Tillerson, and I was amused by the quote even. I mean, when he said the other day, we'll keep negotiating with North Korea until the first bombs drop. I don't, you heard that, right? So I do think they've been looking at the military option. And I think that's a sign of the seriousness of the matter. What I don't know, and I've got an Air Force expert right to my left here, what I don't know is if one can sufficiently, let's say one wanted to take preemptive action against North Korea because we thought there was some sort of imminent threat, could their retaliatory capability be sufficiently suppressed that there would not be a serious threat to the capital of South Korea? There may well be a point at which this administration will take military action. Meanwhile, I think the question is, what is it that anybody can do to move North Korea towards some sort of willingness to talk about a diplomatic settlement to this question. A lot of effort and or energy and commentary has been focused on the Chinese government and whether it, because of the leverage it has through the fact that it supplies food and energy, it's the main provider of critical resources to North Korea. Could it use that leverage to oblige the North Koreans to come to terms? I talked a lot with my Chinese counterpart when I was Deputy Secretary of State, and he was the State Counselor for Foreign Affairs, Dai Bingguo, because in those days we had split the economic and political, so I handled the strategic political dialogue with China. And he always said, and he actually was also in charge of the relationship with North Korea, and he'd say, you overestimate our influence with China. You think we can tell them what to do, but you know they're a difficult client. They're well. We learned some of that during the Cold War too, right? I mean, you know, you empower a client, you give them capabilities of different kinds, and then oh, gee, they develop a mind of their own. And I think that I think there's a little bit of that with the North Korean situation. So that's one. And then the other argument, which I've always had a question about, but they use it constantly. You see it. It's a standard talking point for the Chinese, is that they don't want anything to happen to North Korea that would cause a collapse of the regime and millions of North Korean refugees to go flooding into China. They always pull that argument out. And I've always had difficulty sorting out in my own mind how serious that particular argument is. One last point. And this was a subject, of course, that every administration talks about endlessly. I mean, and I'm sure they're doing it now in this administration, and we certainly did in the Bush administration. And I remember President Bush telling us that when he had met with, I think it was Jiang Zemin, down in Crawford, he told him, he said, look, I want you to get a message to those the North Korean authorities. I want you to assure them that if they give up their nuclear program, everything's on the table. We'll talk about ending the war, moving from an armistice to a peace treaty, about giving them assurances that we're not pursuing regime change, having relations with them. In other words, nothing was off the table in terms of the kinds of assurances we'd be prepared to give North Korea if they would agree to the denuclearization of the peninsula. And I'm sure that the Chinese faithfully conveyed this message, and it's been repeated in various forms since that time. And that also has not yet been enough to move the negotiating situation forward. So I haven't helped you much in terms of, you know, what to expect, but I just guess I've given you some sense of the complexities that we've been, that each administration has been dealing with since all the way back when you failed to go and bomb North Korea.
Thank you very much for that. Just a postscript, if I might. The military is, and the ambassador knows this, the most reluctant of any of our organs of government to want to go to war, because we know things don't go all that well when you go to war. There are always surprises and so forth. But we also know that to have an effective diplomacy, you have to have it backed up by a strong military option. And I assure you the U.S. military does have options for North Korea. There are downsides to any option that you come up with, and it's our job as professional military to make sure that our civilian masters understand what can go wrong and what those downsides are. The President of the United States is faced with a very difficult choice. As bad as some of those outcomes are, a nuclear weapon delivered against Los Angeles or San Francisco is a pretty horrific outcome as well. And so the President of the United States has to decide, am I going to protect the American people? What is the threat to the American people versus what are the downsides of a military option? And that's a difficult decision.
Maybe, I mean, it's such an important topic. Maybe we can just have a couple of more volleys about this. I think the question of what to do about this is a very difficult one. But in the meanwhile, there's certain steps that even with the activity that's taken place, the missile tests he's conducted, the testing of the nuclear capability and so forth, has already precipitated certain actions by us. And I think it's brought us closer to the South Korean government. It's caused us to help even further increase, they're already extremely good friends and we provide a lot of equipment, but even further increase their military capabilities and give them some also protective capabilities, the shield against missiles and so forth. And it's also brought us closer to Japan. And it may have even had the effect of bringing Japan and South Korea a little bit close together. So there have been some of these interesting consequences in the region that have brought us closer together with our most important allies in East Asia.
I absolutely agree with that. And I would only add, I think it has brought us closer to the Japanese as we look at this. And one of the things that I think the Chinese have to consider in their calculus, at some point, will Japan feel threatened enough to come up with their own nuclear weapons, which they could do very quickly? And that certainly would not necessarily be in China's interest to have a nuclear Japan at the time. So I think they have to seriously consider that as they go through their decisions. Let's go to an easier one. The Iranian situation. In order to set the question up here, let me try to clarify something. There was a lot of misinformation in the press about what the president did last Friday. Let me start off with the nuclear agreement, the P5 plus one and the United States and the Iranians. When President Obama signed that agreement, you will recall that he did not submit it to the Senate for ratification. The Congress was concerned about that aspect of it, and so Congress passed a law and said the President of the United States has to report back to the Congress every 90 days and report whether or not the Iranians are in compliance with the agreement. And the law further stipulates that if they're not in agreement, the snapback of sanctions can occur, and it can occur without a filibuster, with a majority vote in the Senate. So last Friday, the president didn't withdraw from the JCPOA. The president responded to the law from the Congress that said, you have to respond, or you have to tell us every 90 days whether they're in compliance or not. And the president, as I understand it, informed the Congress that they are not in compliance. Now the Congress has 60 days. And in that 60 days, Congress can either snap back sanctions, they can do nothing, they can change the law that requires the president to certify. And I don't know, I certainly have no idea what the Congress is going to do, but the ball is in the court of the Congress now. So my question to the ambassador, if Senator Corker were here tonight, what would be your advice to him? And what do you think he would do?
So let's go back a little bit. This is a really interesting question. Setting aside and we got to get into the question of what Iran represents in the Middle East and what the threat is and why some countries are very concerned, including countries that are very good friends of ours, like Israel and the Persian Gulf countries, the Gulf Cooperation Council, led by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, and we can come back to that. But there's a political philosophy issue here that's also interesting. Is it a good idea to make an agreement about something as important as was the subject of Iran's nuclear capability through an artifice that avoided really serious debate in the United States Congress. Because, I mean, I think the way it was done was there was a sort of a default provision, and it would go into effect unless it could be overridden. It was like a bit like trying to override a veto or something. I mean, Congress, it wasn't a treaty. It wasn't even an agreement that was then passed in the form of a law. And I think you could make the argument that, and there was a lot of opposition to it. The whole Republican side of the House was against the agreement. So is it wise for us to pursue those kind of arrangements without ensuring that it's got the kind of consensus support from the American people that you would have, for example, if it were a treaty and got the requisite two-thirds vote for ratification by the Senate? So I just leave you with that question. Now, what would I advise to Mr. Corker? Or maybe, first of all, what do I think the administration is trying to accomplish? I think, number one, the president's trying to keep faith with his position during the campaign and since, that he thought this was not a good agreement. And so I think he wanted to do something about that. But at the same time, I think it's fairly clear that his advisors, Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, were coming to him and saying, well, the agreement may serve our interest. Iran is in technical compliance, and you may not want to just kick the thing over entirely. And so I think you could perhaps argue that this was a skillful way of putting the question into Congress's lap. He did not, as you say, withdraw from the agreement. He didn't even decertify Iran. He simply didn't take any action. And so I think we're going to have to wait and see. Mr. Corker, I wouldn't presume to give him advice, but I'm trying to guess what he might do. He might just try to play for more time. And because if he just plays for more time and doesn't do anything, the status quo will continue. I don't think Iran will break out of the agreement just based on what Mr. Trump did, because they don't want to irritate all the other countries that negotiated the agreement with him. The P5 plus one, it's the permanent five members of the Security Council plus Germany. Well, all the other countries are still committed to this thing. So I think what this might turn out to be not as consequential an event as we might initially have thought it would be.
Very good. You served as...
Oh, I'm sorry, but I should. I should, though, say that I think the one really substantive objection that people have with the agreement is that it's time-limited. It ends after, what, 10 or 15 years? And so I think there's this feeling, well, you know, if you're going to forswear nuclear weapons, why do you only do it for a limited period of time? And besides, aren't you supposed to forswear them according to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty anyway? So I don't know why we gave them that sort of out, and Mr. Tillerson's made an issue of that. And the one other thing I would say is I think some of the president's concerns are really just an expression of frustration about the other aspects of Iran's behavior that haven't got to do with their nuclear program, but would have to do with their behavior in the Middle East generally, whether it's vis-a-vis Israel or Lebanon or Iraq or Syria or Yemen, for that matter.
And they are still number one on the U.S. State Department's list of sponsors of terrorism.
Correct.
Worldwide. One of the concerns that I know the military had with the agreement is the fact, as you mentioned, it's a 10-year agreement, By the way, the clock's running, and we are almost 3 years into that. And so the Iranians could, under the agreement, have a nuclear weapon 7 years from now. 7 years is not all that long to do it. So we gave up billions of dollars so they could finance terrorist activities around the world, and not really that much constraint on them.
You are listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage. We've been hearing a conversation between Ambassador John Negroponte and General Joseph Ralston. They are talking about the status of U.S. national security. This event was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council and recorded on October 19th. We continue back into the discussion during the second half of the program, and we'll finish up with questions from the audience.
Iraq, where you served admirably and nobly as our ambassador to Iraq during a very, very difficult time in the 2004-2005 time period. This week we have had some very disturbing activities go on in the north around the city of Kirkuk between the Kurds and the Iraqi federal forces. I guess my question is, if we could go forward 10 years from now, will Iraq still be a country as we know it today, or will it split into factions?
Right, which of course raises the issue about redrawing maps, and these maps were all, these territorial delineations were made at the fall of the Ottoman Empire, and they were basically made by the British and the French and others, but mainly the British and the French. And will those lines, how long will those lines endure? And yet, on the other hand, people over the years have been very leery of trying to change the map. That's always been a kind of a thing. Oh my God, do we really want to touch these things? Because when you do, are you opening Pandora's box? Whether it's in the Middle East or in Africa, for example, where a lot of these lines are very artificial. I think the situation in Iraq has improved a little bit in the last few years. 2014, I think in June, when ISIS came barreling through there and captured Mosul and then went down the Tigris River and captured a bunch of the other cities and all the way down to Fallujah. And they basically, the Iraqi armed forces have sort of clawed their way back and now seem to be asserting control over most of the country. I think this prime minister, Haider al-Abadi, has been an improvement over his predecessor, Nouri al-Maliki. He's less, he's been less divisive, I think, and less extreme in his political views, a more compromising figure. So I think that's been positive. So 10 years from now, although, you know, it's very hard to make prognoses about Iraq, but I think things could, over these next several years, continue to improve. Now, what about the situation with the Kurds, and who have been good friends of the United States, and we've been good friends of theirs? Actually, we helped with this no-fly zone after the first Gulf War, helped them preserve their identity and and help them establish self-governance. In fact, because there was a no-fly zone since the end of the first Gulf War, the Kurds had actually had more time and experience with self-government than the Iraqis had after Saddam Hussein. So it's a bit concerning now that the Iraqis and the Kurds themselves have come to blows, but our government and others, which had devoted a lot of effort to drawing up a constitution for Iraq and helping them draw one up, it was called the Transitional Administrative Law, and then it led to a constitution that had provisions about all these questions about Iraq being a unitary state, but it would be federalist. And it would take into account the interests of the different parts of the country. And Iraq was enjoying, the Kurdistan was enjoying considerable amount of autonomy. It does still under the present setup. But when ISIS attacked Iraq, the Kurds took advantage of that situation by extending their presence south of the agreed line of delineation, which I believe is called the Green Line. And they took the city of Kirkuk, among other places. And now the Iraqis have pushed back, and the Kurdish armed forces, the Peshmerga, are leaving. I think that's going to leave a bad taste. I think the Kurds are very upset. I think they feel that the United States should help them. On the other hand, we warned them, our government warned them, about not having a referendum on independence. And even if we were somewhat supportive of independence for Iraqi Kurdistan, you got to think about the regional context. The Turks wouldn't want it. The Iranians wouldn't want it. The Syrians wouldn't want it. I think that an independent Kurdistan could end up being sort of stillborn, even if it were to come to pass. And there's some question as to how viable Iraqi Kurdistan would be economically. There's no doubt they know how to administer themselves, and they have their own military capabilities. But would they have the economic wherewithal to really survive as a separate state if they were independent? And of course, that's where Kirkuk was critical, because there's some very important oil fields there, but which I don't think anybody argued that ipso facto belonged to Kurdistan.
You were our ambassador to Mexico. And Mexico has been in the press a lot, not only for the wall, for immigration, but for NAFTA. What do you think is the likely outcome on NAFTA?
Yeah. Well, I never thought NAFTA would become a dirty word, but it obviously has. And that has a very complex explanation about the nature of work and globalization, and many, many different things, and how much of the problems that people attribute to NAFTA have really been caused by trade, and how much of them have been caused by increased modernization of technology and so forth. And it's hard to say. But in any case, Mr. Trump, that was another one of his campaign promises. And I think he was dissuaded from completely pulling the plug on the North American Free Trade Agreement by his agriculture secretary, who pointed out to him that Mexico was the first or second most important market for every one of our states that export agricultural products. And of course, a big market for manufacturers as well. NAFTA has been enormously beneficial, I think, to both sides. And the levels of trade have quadrupled or quintupled since the early 1990s. And Mexico has really aligned itself more with the United States. If you read the literature in the 1990s, I think it was Alan Riding, the New York Times correspondent, wrote a rather famous book at the time called Distant Neighbors. That was the characterization of the U.S.-Mexico relationship for all the different historic reasons. And then after 9/11, they became really close partners with us on a whole range of issues, security, migration, and so forth. To the point that today, actually, there's not net migration of Mexicans into the United States. If anything, it's a little bit, at the moment, in the other direction. Although the flow of people from south of the border, the large flow, has been coming from Central America, not Mexico. So we've developed a very strong partnership over all these years, and I think, and it would be ironic. I was at a meeting just 2 days ago in Washington, where a group of Mexican military were there, and they were talking about the importance of interoperability between the Mexican and the United States armed forces. You would have never heard that said 25 years ago. That interoperability would have been a danger, not an asset. And now they have officers up in the NORTHCOM headquarters in Colorado, and so on and so forth. So it would be really the height of irony if we have the Mexican military, who were traditionally very leery of the United States, arguing for interoperability with us, and our economic actors on our side trying to disengage from the Mexican economy. I think it'd be a terrible mistake. And I think enough of the important interests in our country, political and economic, are stepping up to make that point to the administration. But the outcome is still in doubt.
I can't help but comment. When I was vice chairman in 1996, I went back and did ask the staff to do a study. We had more military-to-military interaction in 1996 with Mongolia than we did Mexico. And so it was zero. And so to see how that has progressed since 1996, 21 years, is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, the big decision, I was ambassador to Mexico from 1989 to 93, and that was a very good period in the relationship. It's when we negotiated the NAFTA, and President Bush Sr. was very committed to the relationship, and I think part of the explanation is that he's Texan, so I think Texans understand the significance of this big neighbor that they have just to the south of them. But in those days, the big decision on the military front was simply, whom would we send from Washington to the annual Independence Day celebrations, right? That was, would it be a 3-star or a 4-star? And if so, from what service and so on and so on. That was the only issue we decided every year. It's gotten a heck of a lot better than that.
Absolutely. It's time for questions from the audience. Who has a question?
With respect to North Korea, what would the downside be to unilaterally declaring a no first strike agreement with North Korea and welcoming them into the nuclear fellowship, a nuclear community?
Well, okay, this goes to the question of whether you think, I mean, the question to be decided there is, do we think that we can live with a nuclear-armed North Korea? And I think that is the leap that we're very reluctant to make because, among other things, we think they would use that as a way of imposing their will on South Korea. Don't forget, it's half a country. And there's the other half there. And if you acquiesce in a nuclear North Korea, what does that say about what we think of our more successful and partner in the South? So that would be one of the things that I would ask you about. And then what does it say about the non-proliferation regime? I think this is a real watershed, it seems to me, in nuclear nonproliferation policy. Whether or not to accept a nuclear armed North Korea, I think, is a very, very big question.
I would add two other things. What confidence do we have that they would abide by the agreement, given their past history of backing out of what they have agreed to? And secondly, North Korea is one of the great proliferators around the world of military technology. And I think the concern would be, who would they share nuclear technology with under that aspect?
Could I add on that? When Israel bombed the Syrian reactor in 2006 that was being built secretly by Bashar al-Assad, over there in eastern Syria, who was building it? Who were the workers who were building it? They were North Korean workers. Amazing. But it's just one example of their role in these proliferation-type activities. Anyway, the option you have suggested, just so that we're clear, is one that has been put forward by various thinkers on this subject. So it's I don't think it's one that is dismissed out of hand, but I do think one would have to evaluate the risks very carefully.
My question, and I can understand if you decide that you don't want to necessarily answer it, is there any consideration that the people in China may be sufficiently afraid of whatever North Korea might do, that if we were to do something in North Korea, they might turn a blind eye to our actions there?
That who might turn a blind eye?
China.
I see. Well, we've seen situations in the past where China, or I'm thinking back during the period of the Cold War or the Soviet Union, did not react as strongly to some step we took as some people might have anticipated. And they just sort of, I'm thinking in Vietnam where I served, when we mined Haiphong or bombed Hanoi. I remember going with President Nixon and Dr. Kissinger to the summit with Leonid Brezhnev, and they invited us out to their dacha, and we met just about four or five on our side and about four or five on the Russian side. And they treated us to, they had all of them, Brezhnev, Podgorny, Kosygin, one other, and they treated us to a four and a half hour diatribe, each of them. And the longer their talk went on, the more I realized they weren't going to do anything. I mean, that's sometimes what you do when you're not going to take any concrete action, is you fill the air with a lot of words. And that's what they did. And so, but this would be a huge thing, us attacking North Korea. I think it's better to work with China and try to, I think where the diplomatic effort needs to be invested is to work with China and try to reach some agreement with China on what kind of Korean Peninsula do we visualize. And then if we can reach agreement with them on that, then I don't think it's too hard to work it backwards from that. But that's so far, that's been elusive.
The only thing I would add, I think that is, it's going to be very critical when President Trump goes to China next month, and what kind of discussions are going to be had during that time period. So we'll see.
Yeah, and he's taking a major swing through Asia, right? He's got a 14-day trip through five different countries. He's got Japan, China, Korea, Vietnam, and the Philippines.
Hi, I have a question for the ambassador. So you kind of spoke to some of your experience in Iraq. I'd be curious to hear your feelings on what do you think we as the United States have learned from our experiences there?
What we've learned from our experience in Iraq. Well, of course, there's so many different, there was so much fallout from the Iraq situation, including the creation of a position that I later filled, which was the Directorate of National Intelligence, because one of the things was this whole question of the bad intelligence we had about whether or not there were WMD in Iraq. So that was sort of a lesson in and of itself. It's not the major lesson, but our experience in Iraq ended up precipitating a demand for intelligence reform. And I'm not even arguing that it was necessarily the best reform to make, but there was a concern about the quality of our intelligence, particularly the analytic quality of our intelligence. But I think our experience in Iraq, and it's a lesson I'm afraid we've learned more than once, which is the limits of intervention, and both the limits and the costs. Look, I served in Vietnam. I was served in Central America, and I served in the Middle East. So I've seen quite a few of these interventions in that period of time. We tend very often to think, all we have to do is get rid of so-and-so, And if when that individual goes, it's just going to be a piece of cake, and everything will come up roses. So if Diem would just get overthrown or leave, then things would be okay in Vietnam, and the Buddhists would stop protesting. And yeah. If Somoza gets kicked out of Nicaragua, if Saddam would only go, and it seems to happen over and over and over again. I'm hoping that one of these days we will get cured of this interventionist tendency and of thinking that by replacing somebody at the top of a system that we disapprove of, that somehow the rest is just then going to fall in place. It's usually just the beginning of your problem, not the end of it. Well, yeah, but let's fix it. You know, and the trouble is, and it's not a partisan thing, and it's not a left-right thing. People will see something happening in Rwanda, and it's just awful, or it's in the Congo, or wherever it is. Well, gee, why don't we just go in there and fix it? It just ain't that easy. I've tried various aspects of nation building during the course of my 44 years in the government, and I can attest to you, at least for me, the personal lesson in my career is how difficult it is.
We promised you you'd be out on time. All I can say is, Mr. Ambassador, I can't thank you enough for coming here and sharing your wisdom, and I truly mean that, your wisdom from the years and experience. I know everyone will be excited to listen to you tomorrow, but once again, thank you very much for tonight.
Thank you for listening to Addressing Alaskans today on Alaska Public Media. We've just finished hearing questions presented to former Ambassador John Negroponte and General Joseph Ralston. If you missed the beginning of the show, you can always go back and listen to it again by visiting the Addressing Alaskans page at alaskapublic.org. I'm your host and producer for today's show, Eric Bork for KSKA Anchorage.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. The views expressed are those of the hosts and participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.